Good evening and welcome back to another week of the Alaska Identity Project. My name is Adrienne Lopez, broadcasting here on KTOO News Juno 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned and coming back every week to this great show on K2. In the first part tonight, I'll be talking with Amy Gulick, author of Salmon in the Trees, among many other accomplishments, which we'll discuss tonight in the interview. In the second half of the show, at 7:30, I'll be talking with Lori Hege, music teacher at Glacier Valley Elementary School, director of the Juneau, Alaska Music Matters, called JAM, and the 2011 Alaska Teacher of the Year. Reminder to listeners, you can find the Alaska Identity Project on Facebook. You can like the show there and stay up to date with weekly interviews. Follow on Twitter at Alaska ID Project. And you can go to my blog, adrienchile.blogspot.com, and I have the recordings of each show posted there on a weekly basis. And a quick shout-out to women. It's International Women's Day. If you haven't noticed, March 8th is a day celebrated around the world. A quick reflection, when I was down in Chile, they would shower us with these flowers and almost a little bit chauvinistic approach to it, but there are a lot of campaigns and causes out there, like Oxfam, trying to really highlight the issues that women still face, especially in some of the poorer countries. So it's important to stay active and aware of those things. My first guest tonight, Amy Gulick, I'm trying to pronounce that name right. She's a professional photographer and writer whose work has appeared in Outdoor Photographer, Audubon, Nature's Best Photography, National Wildlife, Sierra, National Parks, and many other publications. Gulick's work has received numerous honors, including the prestigious Daniel Hausberg Wilderness Image Award from the Alaska Conservation Foundation and a Lowell Thomas Award from the Society of American Travel Writers Foundation. She's also the recipient of a Philip Hyde Grant Award for her work in the Tongass National Forest of Alaska and a Mission Award, both presented by the Northern Nature Photography Association. Her book, Salmon in the Trees, Life in Alaska's Tongass Rainforest, is a 2010 Independent Publisher Book Award winner. You can visit that website at salmoninthetrees.org and go there right now and you can kind of look at the images as we talk about her work here tonight. Gulick is a founding fellow of the International League of Conservation Photographers, whose mission is to further environmental and cultural conservation through ethical photography. She's a conservation columnist as well for Currents Magazine and the North American Nature Photography Association, as well as a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists. Whew! Amy, you stay busy.
I do. I don't think I need to say anything after all that.
No, actually, I was like, well, those are some of my questions. No, just kidding. So thanks for taking the time. I know that we actually confirmed this interview months ago because you were going to be passing through Juneau. And let's just talk about what brings you to Juneau and what you'll be doing over the next couple days here.
Sure. I'm primarily here. I'm giving a talk at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center tomorrow night. Actually, I'll give two talks. Well, the first one is at 6:30, and then I'll repeat it again at 8. So if you can make either one, that'd be great.
Okay.
And I'll be there. I'm going to be showing way more photos than are actually in the book. And I'm going to talk about my adventures making the book and where I all went and the people I met and just what a fabulous part of the world this is.
Excellent.
And then I'll have the book there as well. If anyone's interested in buying it or having me sign it, if you already have it, please come out. Love to meet you.
Great. And then on Saturday there's something as well, right?
Well, Saturday I'm just participating. The Admiralty, I think it's called the Admiralty Voices event at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. I believe that starts at 2 and goes until there's a potluck at 6. And then I think Hank Lentfer is going to be speaking at 7:30.
Okay.
But the event that's starting at 2, I think there's two different panels, kind of like a scientific panel and then the more kind of artist panel. But the whole event is just intended to be a celebration of Admiralty, and I'm thrilled to be in town. You know, this is all coinciding with that. Yeah.
Just
some terrific people are going to be in town for that.
Do you expect for the event tomorrow night, where you'll be speaking, people to come out? Have you heard positive reception from when you've been in town before? People have bought your book here in Juneau?
Yeah, I was just here in the fall. I have an exhibit now that's based on the book, and that was showing at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center the month of September, and then we had an opening for that, and I gave a presentation then, and yeah, it was a terrific response, but we did have free beer involved.
Oh, well, that helps. Probably not tomorrow night. We shouldn't say
that
on
tomorrow.
Air.
No, I can't say that.
So let's tell people a little bit about Salmon in the Trees. I know I've been looking through it. It's a gorgeous book for those out there who don't have it. You can buy it at the Jack, I believe, right? Among other many other places.
I believe so.
In town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Hearthside.
And Hearthside as well. So you're obviously a photographer, but what made you interested in writing about this topic? And also, how did you get this name, A Salmon in the Tree?
Well, again, as a photographer and a writer, specifically a nature photographer and writer, I'm always on the lookout for interesting stories. And a while back, several years ago, I read an article somewhere, just a magazine article. It was actually a very kind of a dry scientific article, and it talked about this remarkable connection between salmon and trees in this part of the world. And even though it was this dry scientific article, it still just resonated with me. It's like, whoa, how can there be salmon inside trees? I mean, people think that this title of the book, Salmon in the Trees, they think it's a metaphor or something.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it just kind of stands for something, you know, kind of esoteric, like fairies in the wind or, you know.
Something maybe native related.
You know, right. Or, you know, or again, there can't possibly be salmon in the trees, but there are. And again, this so resonated with me, and it just wouldn't leave my brain, you know, and I'd wake up thinking about it, and it's like, all right, fine, that's it, I'm going, you know, I've got to do this, you know, and I think that's how I kind of get all my inspiration. It's like when a story or an idea just kind of grabs me and it just won't let go, and this one definitely wouldn't let go. So I knew I had to come up here, photograph it, tell this, you know, incredible story. So the way this works, people in Southeast Alaska, I don't need to tell you this, but you know, this part of the world, the forest and the sea here are so intertwined that you really can't separate the two. And probably no other species here relies more on both the forest and the sea than salmon do. So salmon, they bring the ocean nutrients with them in their bodies when they leave the ocean and return to their spawning streams. And then the bears in this part of the world, and there are a lot of bears in this part of the world, some of the highest densities of black and brown bears, you know, in the world. There's more than 4,000 salmon spawning streams, you know, so you know, during salmon time, you know, millions of wild salmon are filling all of those spawning streams. All of those bears are hungry and they're waiting for them. And so the bears are there, and they're plucking the salmon out of the streams, and oftentimes they're actually carrying the salmon into the forest so they can avoid conflict with other bears.
And there's a picture in your book of that.
Yeah.
The bear
fighting
in the middle of the
and it doesn't take long. You know, all you got to do is hang out on a salmon stream when the salmon are coming in and watching bears, and you see they don't, unless it's really a dominant bear, they don't hang around very long. They'll kind of grab a salmon and go, you know, off into the forest, you know, again, because they're all trying to kind of avoid, you know, each other's ire. You know, bears don't really like being around each other. They're not social animals. So anyway, and actually researchers have found that one bear can carry 40 fish from a stream in 8 hours.
Wow.
That's just one bear. So again, if you add up all the bears in this part of the world, all those salmon, all those spawning streams, this is going on all throughout Southeast Alaska. You know, you do the math, that adds up to a lot of salmon that are dragged and dropped into the forest. And over time, all of the nutrients from those salmon carcasses then decompose into the soil, and the trees absorb them through their roots. And scientists have actually been able to trace a particular form of marine nitrogen. It's called nitrogen-15, in trees near salmon streams that they can link directly back to the fish. And it turns out there's a lot of nitrogen-15 in those trees near salmon streams. It's something like it's 70% of nitrogen in streamside foliage is of ocean origin, which means it's coming from the salmon.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's like, I mean, again, and you know, I get really excited when I talk about this, because I still, you know, after years of working on this, I just still think it's the coolest connection ever. And then, you know, and if you can understand how all this works, and then it still works, which is amazing, you know, that this connection is still here and hasn't been broken, then you get this place. You know, there's, and then you just see that everything here is connected. And it's interesting when I explain all this to people, and especially in the slideshow is really fun because I, you know, illustrate this whole, how this all works, you know, through photos. And, and they're, you know, and you just, I always kind of watch people in the audience, and you just see the light bulb go on and they start smiling and they're like, oh, wow, you know, that is cool. And then in the next sentence they're going, well, of course there's salmon in the trees here.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, if you just think about it, I mean, it's a very unexpected yet perfectly natural connection. You know, but if you just give it a little bit of thought, you're like, well, that makes perfect sense. But it's not something we intuitively think about.
Yeah, of course. Well, do you go into that, the science part of it in the book? Is that something, I didn't actually read the book, I looked at the picture.
Yes, yeah. And that's something else I definitely want to mention about the book. While I did all the photography and I did some of the writing, there's just this star-studded cast of Alaskan contributors contributors to this book, mm-hmm. and I'm very honored and humbled and very proud that they contributed not only their writings, but Ray Troll, you know, very beloved artist
yes,
in
Southeast. Yes, he was on the show. Funny guy.
Yes, he is. He contributes illustrations. Richard Nelson is a well-known radio personality, does the radio show Encounters. There's a CD in the book by him. John Straley from Sitka contributed. Again, it's just it's my dream team of contributors to the book.
Well, did they just hear about you doing this? Was there talk when you wanted to start it and they all came on board? Or did
I sought them out and I contacted them. And, yeah, many people have asked me, like, how did you get all these, you know, great, you know, artists and contributor writers and the whole bit to do this? And it's like, well, it certainly wasn't my charm or good looks. And I didn't have a lot of money, you know, to be able to make any of this happen. But, you know, I just told them, hey, I'm going to celebrate your home and you. You know, and you meaning, you know, the people who live here as well. Mm-hmm. And nobody even batted an eye or hesitated. They're like, sure, of course I'm on board.
And this is just a small kind of world in Southeast, too.
Exactly.
I mean, Alaska
exactly.
in general, but...
No, I learned that very quickly.
Yeah. They're like, sure. It's pretty easy. So when you started, did you think this is the end of objective? This is what I hope to achieve with this book. And has it changed since kind of what your initial expectations were?
That's a great question. I mean, I set out, you know, to make a book that would celebrate this place mm-hmm. and call attention, raise awareness to just how incredible it is and how fortunate, you know, we, you know, not only Alaska, you know, as a state, but, you know, we as a nation, you know, because 80% of Southeast is a national forest and it's our largest national forest. I'm incredibly fortunate we are to have this and to have it. And this is what I think really makes, well, there's so many things that make, you know, Southeast Alaska and the Tongass unique. But when most people in the lower 48 hear the words national forest, they think of an inland forest. They think of a place where they go and they visit and they maybe go for a hike or maybe they go fishing or hunting or something like that. And then they drive a long way and they go back home. And here, it's like, people here, you don't go visit the Tongass. It's like, you live here.
Raining on top of it.
Well, I mean, you know, you're in it. I mean, maybe not technically by the boundaries, you know, but you walk across the street and you are technically, you know, in the boundary of the National Forest. But I would never separate the two. It's like, people are such an integral part of this place. And that's another thing I think that makes it so unique is that, you know, people you know, make their living off of the forest. They recreate in it. They certainly fill their freezers with very delicious things. I quickly learned to love the way of life here just for the food alone. I mean, everywhere I went, the best meals I've ever had in my life were in somebody's home in Southeast in whatever community I was in. And, you know, people would pull out this incredible salmon or venison or blueberries or, you know, something that they had harvested or their family had harvested. And it was just amazing. Yeah. I mean, I'm utterly, thoroughly spoiled from spending so much time up here.
King crab. A colleague of mine at work said today, I'm so tired eating king crab. I'm like, are you serious? That's pretty rough life. So, Amy, you've obviously, you're talking about your book here in Juneau, but Salmon in the Trees, for those listening, Amy Gulick, yay. What about nationally? How has the reception been outside of Alaska, and what kind of audiences, or where have you spoken to people about this?
Yeah, no, the reception outside, you know, it has been terrific. I think all you have to do is say, you know, somebody's coming and they're going to be talking or showing photos of Alaska. And you get this thing. Alaska has this incredible mystique for people that are outside of Alaska. For those who have been here, you know, they love it. They can't wait to come back. For those who have never been here, again, it just holds this. They just smile. I mean, they just get this smile on their face, and I'm not quite sure why. I'm not really sure what the mystique is. I mean, you know, a lot of people still think that everybody here, you know, lives in igloos and they travel by dog sled, and you know, so there's kind of that, or maybe the whole Northern Exposure TV show, you know, kind of did.
Well, the reality shows out there too,
right? But no, people love, you know, hearing about Alaska. Not only the wildlife and the beauty, but just Alaskans are very intrigued by. You know, how do you live? How do you live in Alaska?
Yeah,
because they think it's very different than where they live. And in many ways it is. Yeah. But in many ways, you know, there are a lot of similarities too.
Uh-huh. And so you've spoken to groups of all kinds, because it's on your website that you do speaking. mm-hmm. as well as photography and writing and all these other things. But do you get hired on by corporate groups or nonprofits? Or?
You know, it's mainly, say like photo clubs or, you know, anybody who, any kind of like organization has an interest in wildlife or nature. I'm finding fishing groups are fantastic, especially for this particular, book.
Yeah,
It's primarily does focus on salmon.
On salmon. They might not know the salmon are in the tree.
Right.
Oops. And so recently your article was featured in the Washington Post, or the book was mentioned in the article called Wildlife Photographers Turn Their Cameras Towards Conservation. Have you worked with some of the other photographers that were mentioned in this article, these conservation?
I have, actually. I'm a founding fellow of a group called the International League of Conservation Photographers, and not sure how many we're up to now. I think we have over 100 photographers.
Oh, wow.
And we're all over the world, and that's what's really neat. And, you know, in general, nature photography, and especially wildlife photography, can be a very solitary pursuit, you know, because you have to spend a lot of time in wild places waiting, really, you know, for wildlife to show up or something. And we're all off, you know, all of us that are involved in this group, and we're all off in different parts of the world, usually by ourselves or maybe with an assistant or something, but I'm just spending a lot of time out there. And so it was really great when we all kind of came together and, you know, just, you know, sharing stories, of course, is always fun, you know, because everybody has great stories to share. But then we realized it's like, wow, between all 100 plus of us, we've got the world covered.
You know, corner.
And which was really kind of neat, you know, because if we need to come together on, say, a project that's going to, you know, highlight a certain part of the world or maybe a certain topic, it's, you know, we don't have to send people out there. Mm-hmm. And for years, it's like, no, we can just kind of pool all of our images and pull together, you know, some kind of, whether it's, a book, which we have, you know, produced books that might cover a certain, you know, maybe a pressing topic or an urgent topic. We just did one on oceans, and we just did one on water, you know, what freshwater means to the world. You know, things like that. Yeah, but again, we didn't have to send people out for years to come back with these images. We just said, okay, you know, what do you have? What do you have?
And there you go, bam.
Yeah, and it's just nice to know you're not the only one out there doing this, too.
Alone. Well, you helped found this organization, the Fellow of International League of Conservation Photographers, which you think conservation voters sometimes. How many people were involved in the founding, and what was this realization of the people that founded it that you needed to do with your work?
Right. I think there was about 40 of us that originally came together. And we actually, we convened in Anchorage, in 2000, I'm going to say 5, I think it was. Yeah, it was part of what's called the World Wilderness Congress. Mm. And I think those congresses go on every 4 years, and that's an international gathering of indigenous people, governments, NGOs, it's a great mix of people that, you know, come together to kind of talk about the world's issues when it comes to, say, you know, conservation or, you know, whether it's climate change or, again, water or, you know, social justice, that kind of cover everything. And a very visionary woman named Christina Mittermeier, she was involved with a group called Conservation International. And she's a photographer herself. And she works on a lot of different, you know, issues, again, whether it's, indigenous, you know, rights or water, you know, clean air, whatever it is. And she just saw that a lot of communications materials that would go out, you know, to whether it's governments or, you know, again, conferences, were just really poor in the visual department. You know, just, you know, kind of a photo that, and not to disparage scientists, but, you know, their forte is science usually. And, it just maybe a photo that a scientist kind of grabbed with a, you know, with their iPhone or something like that. And was just thinking, gosh, you know, we could, you know, because visuals, you know, as human beings, I think we're very visual creatures. Mm-hmm. And I think we respond, whether we know it or not, to really strong visuals. So she thought, hey, you know, I'm a photographer. I work with a lot of these photographers who are out there on their own doing all this stuff. Why don't I get everybody together, pool all of our, you know, our talents and our images, and then I can actually, you know, help improve some of these communication materials that are going on out there. And she's really been a powerhouse behind the organization.
That's great. And have you been received by governments around the world? Or
I mean, the organization, our work has. We always try to, you know, our work, again, whether we're putting together a book or something, you know, the book is going to be, you know, a tool that'll be used by, say, whether it's the leading scientist on, you know, I don't know, you know, primates or whales or something like that. And if they are going to go meet with the head of whatever government it is that they're trying to say, convince that, hey, you know, whales are really important to you and here's why and they're important to your country, that at least they can, you know, they can come in, you know, with this incredible book of images or give an incredible presentation, you know, that our images help to put together. And it really does. I think what powerful photographs do is they inspire us. You know, they inspire us, they move us. You know, there's a connection there, and it's usually an emotional connection.
Of course. Now, have any of these campaigns faced specific challenges, or that you felt have failed, or I mean, have there been successful and failed campaigns in some of the work that the conservation group has done?
No, I'd have to think about all of them.
I know there's an example of a guy in Honduras with the jaguars, and I wonder, you know, if some of that work has ever been exposed and how he's really helping, you know, to get it on the map, or it's talked about for one time and then goes away.
Right. I think that's the challenge in any kind of, you know, issue, or if you're trying to advance something, whether you're trying to protect jaguars or whales or whatever, salmon, you know, or whatever it is, it's an ongoing, you know, it's never kind of a one-time thing. And there's, you have to have a lot of staying power, and then you have to, you know, you've got to reach out and form partnerships and meet a lot of different folks and, you know, all kind of work together. Cause, you know, I always say, you know, our photos aren't going to save the world, but at least we can engage people and get people talking about whatever it is we'd like them to start maybe paying attention to.
Yeah. That's great. Very good work. So here in Alaska, I mean, outside of Southeast, have you looked at other conservation issues? Have you thought about, okay, the next project would be here in our state with your photography?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because everybody, you know, asked me that. the book came out almost 2 years ago.
Okay.
And, I mean, literally, right off, I mean, it was still, the ink was still drying, you know, and the book was in my hands. And right away, I was really shocked. I was like, so what are you working on now? And here I just spent, you know, 3 years of my life, you know, doing, I mean, really obsessed and consumed, because it is an all-consuming project to put something like this together. So I just spent 3 years of my life, what I kind of felt like was like a gestation period. And so when I finally was holding the book in my hands, it was as if I just gave birth. And so for people to say, well, what are you working on now? It's like, well, wait a minute. You know, I just gave birth. You know, let me raise this thing. Let me get it out in the world and, you know, make it be a good citizen. And 2 years later, I'm still doing that, which has really been, for me, incredibly gratifying, because I love talking about this part of the world. And of course, I love being in this part of the world. But it's neat to see that it's life, that it has staying power. Mm. And it's there's just a lot of interest. I now have an exhibit that's based on the book that, you know, as I mentioned, was actually toured all throughout Southeast Alaska this past summer, or spring and summer.
And
one of the communities I was in here in Southeast is Wrangell, and Wrangell loved it so much that they are now about to get a permanent exhibit of salmon in the trees. Yeah.
Right.
So I'm working on making that happen. So again, it's such a great story, and, you know, just this whole concept of salmon in the trees, and again, what that means for people who live here and what it means for, really, you know, the rest of the world in a way. I mean, this is such a unique part of the world. I don't know if people who live here always, you know, really, you know, and it's human nature. You know, wherever we live, we kind of tend to take it for granted, right? So when I was traveling around and working on the book, I'd get to meet incredible people all throughout Southeast, and I'd start telling them, you know, what, say, because I live down in Washington State, and, you know, we used to have, I mean, just incredibly, you know, magnificent, you know, what I call salmon rainforest, and we don't anymore. And so I'd be telling people here in Southeast, you know, what we used to have. I mean, we used to have, you know, the greatest salmon producing system in the entire world. I mean, more salmon than probably ever came out of Southeast, and, you know, bigger trees and more diversity just because it's a warmer climate. And about 100, 150 years ago, that all unraveled, you know, and unraveled pretty quickly. But it was funny because whenever I'd kind of lament about that, what has happened down there, everyone up here would kind of look at me as if I was this little 5-year-old, you know, girl who was about to cry, and they'd pat me on the head and they'd go, oh, don't worry, honey, that will never happen here. You know, and I hope it doesn't. And that's part of the reason why I made the book, again, to just say, hey, this is unbelievable, you know, that we still have salmon in the trees somewhere, you know, in their historical range. And not only do you have it here, but you have it in droves. which is pretty neat.
Yeah. Is it outside of Southeast Alaska? I mean, I'm from Valdez, and I know there's a lot of commercial fishing of salmon there. I don't know if they've been able to find salmon in the trees in other
areas. Right. You know, I don't know how much farther north. The original coastal temperate rainforest in North America started in South Central Alaska. And there's like, and if you look on them, there's a great map actually in the book that shows that. And it's kind of like a little fringe that kind of goes down, mm-hmm. you know, through South Central. Southeast is really kind of, well, the heart of what's left. But then coastal British Columbia, coastal Washington, Oregon, and then the Redwood Forest in Northern California. But of all of that in North America, 44% is gone. And it was developed, whether it was farming or, you know,
dams.
Just civilization, you know, housing, you know, logging, you know, whatever, for whatever reason, you know, that's, mm-hmm. those original forests are gone. And mm-hmm. and the salmon went with them. And, you know, and all the things you still have here, you know, we don't have down there anymore. But, and again, so when I would go around and I meet people here in Southeast and, you know, again, going back to that, I think that incredible way of life that the salmon here in the forest allow people to live, and the fact that it's public land. It's like you're not kind of relegated to like a little area or something. I mean, you've got 17 million acres of public land, you know, that you can go fish on and hunt on and get and fill your freezer. And so, and I remember talking to people here about that and just raving about, again, the food, you know, that they're eating and just the... And you know, it's fun. It's fun to go out and gather that stuff too. And it is, and it does become a way of life. And so I tell them, you know, well, you know, down where I am, you know, you can go out fishing, but you know, chances of catching anything are very slim, and you're going to be combat fishing, you know, with, you know, 50 of your closest friends, you know, right next to you. And you know, we have very strict seasons and strict limits, you know, because there's really not that much left, if anything. And they all kind of look at me, you know, kind of quizzically and say, Well, really? Like, you mean, doesn't everybody have a salmon, you know, full of venison and a freezer.
I would love to try that.
Yeah, doesn't everybody have a freezer full of salmon and venison and blueberries and, you know, things that they just, you know, and can't everybody go out and dip net 25 salmon in a day? And it's like, no, you can't.
Yeah.
Even if you wanted to, you know, it's just, you know, the opportunities just aren't there.
Yeah. No, so, before, we only have a couple minutes left, but you do highlight some local people here, right? I mean, there's a profile on Becky James here from Juneau.
Yeah, there's a great diverse mix of people featured in the book, and from all over, you know, from many different communities. There's Native folks,
Gordon
scientists, you know, guides, fishermen, you know, business owners. Again, really, really tried to just kind of include a diverse group of people here.
Wow.
And just fascinating. And then, you know, kind of again, you know, that common thread that I think weaves, you know, all the communities in Southeast together and a lot of the people together really are salmon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was very fortunate, you know, being able to go around to a lot of the communities in Southeast and spend a lot of time in them. And, you know, everyone has their own personality. You know, each town does. They're very, very different from one another.
Interesting, yeah.
I mean, very different from one another. But the common thread that binds everybody together here and all the communities, I think, is salmon. It's pretty neat, you know, and it's just neat to see the community that salmon builds, the cultures, you know, that salmon have built, you know, since time immemorial. Has been, you know, astounding.
Yeah.
And then today, you know, in the modern world, to see that, you know, how salmon still affect people here. And I always ask people, again, when people kind of look at me and they say, oh, don't worry, honey, that'll never happen here. You know, we're never going to lose those things. And I say, well, I hope not. I said, but just imagine, what would your life be like if there were no salmon here?
Mm.
And that just stops people dead in their tracks.
Interesting question.
You know, because it's something you just, again, kind of take for granted and assume this is always going to be here. It's like, well, what if it didn't? I mean, what if that all went away? You know, what would this place be without salmon? And no one... Yeah, it is a scary thought. And no one wants to go there, so.
No. And actually, I love this, I guess it's a quote, I don't know if you invented it, but a place where trees grow salmon grow trees, and a rich cycle of life carries on through millennia. That's a neat thought.
Yeah, I think that really just sums up what this place is all about.
And what your book, Salmon in the Trees, Amy Gulick, who is the author. We had illustrations by Ray Troll. You'll be speaking tomorrow at the Mendenhall Lecture Series. That starts at 7?
6:30.
6:30, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Great, Amy. Well, thanks for coming on the Alaska Identity Project.
Well, thank you for having me.
Fun to have you. Best of luck with your next project, of course, years down the line. Enjoy this
with the next child.
Great. Thanks. And people, one real quick, they can go to a website if they want more information. It's, what's your website again?
Salmoninthetrees.org.
Salmoninthetrees.org. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks again. Stay tuned in the Alaska Identity Project. This is Adrian Lopez. We'll be back in the next half hour talking to Lori Hege. She's 2011 Alaska Teacher of the Year.
Forget the past, yeah, 'cause I've got a ring. for what it's worth, yeah. The outcome is worth the hurt, no looking back.
This is Adrienne Lopez here on KTOO News Juneau 104.3 in Alaska's capital city. Thanks for staying tuned on this wonderful evening. We first had Amy Gulick. She is author of Salmon in the Trees and will be speaking tomorrow night in the Mendenhall Lecture Series at 6:30. And the music you're just listening to is from our local Juno star, Meg Mackey. She was actually at the Hangar in the Rookery last week. She's now based out of Anchorage, but will be releasing a scheduled album to be released next month. Her album is Eat Your Heart Out. So stay tuned for Meg Mackey's music to be released. This half hour, we're speaking with Lori Hagee. She is a music teacher and librarian at Glacier Valley Elementary School. She has 15 years' experience in the classroom, first teaching at the University of Alaska Southeast for the MAT course in elementary education, emphasizing philosophy, differentiated learning, brain research, and arts integration. Recently, Lori was one of 50 teachers selected nationally as a Yale School of Music Distinguished Music Educator and was one of 10 musicians selected internationally to serve as an Abreu Fellow at the New England Conservatory in Boston to help create instrumental programs in the U.S. that engage and motivate children at a young age. She chose to return to her hometown of Juneau to start such a program called JAM, Juneau Alaska Music Matters, where all 120 kindergarten and first graders at Glacier Valley Elementary School receive violin instruction as part of their school day for 90 minutes a week. She was honored to represent Alaska teachers as the 2011 Alaska Teacher of the Year. Wow, Lori, you have quite a list of accomplishments there. Thanks for taking the time to come on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful to have you, and congrats for being Teacher of the Year last year. I don't know if they've named the 2012 one yet, or that comes out later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, great. And, I actually first heard you at Thunder Mountain School this year, where you gave, I think, a message to the teachers, was it, in August,
yes.
Correct? And I was just so inspired. You had so much passion for what you do, and I really... Your name has come up in other things as well, and
thank you.
Juno's very lucky to have you. My first question is about why you decided to move back to Juno. You've been outside doing all these amazing things, and you decided it was important to come back here, right?
Very much so. Well, this community is incredible, and when I was selected for this fellowship to study the El Sistema program in Venezuela and work on bringing a music program for young kids, I couldn't imagine a better place to bring it back to this community. And it's really Juno that already made it prime to happen, because when I started teaching here 15 years ago. 15 years ago. We started a charter school for the arts.
Okay.
And have since moved over to Glacier Valley, a Title I school, and
mm-hmm.
emphasized bringing arts to kids who may not necessarily have that opportunity.
Okay.
And the community has just given donations to support bringing artists into the classroom. And so we have visual arts, drama, music, dance, and we've been doing that now for about 7 years. The Boston New England Conservatory learned about me through this program and what this community has done. So it was only right to come back here and bring it to our community. So, we have 120 kids, and we're hoping to continue to grow.
Excellent. Now, the name JAM, did that come from somewhere else, or did you just kind of invent that?
I did. Yeah. I thought... You know, I'd really love for this to be something that is district-wide in our
mm-hmm.
schools. And even though the program in Venezuela happens mostly after school for kids as a safe haven
mm-hmm.
for young children to be in a place where it's productive and they're working together on something bigger than themselves.
Yeah.
I really wanted to have it be a part of a child's education because there's so much research about what instrumental music does for the brain, helping kids prepare for school, and I wanted to make sure that our kids had that opportunity before we moved into an after-school model. So the goal of JAM is to really begin a in-school model for kindergarten and first grade where they all get that foundation and then move into an after-school program in second grade.
Okay. And so they have that available here as well? There's
they
a second
do.
Grade program?
The second grade will start next year.
Okay.
So
it's just starting.
We've been expanding 1 year at a time. So we started out with kindergarten and, you know, I think all of us were a little anxious about how that would work. Mm. And initially I was thinking, well, I'll start with first grade. Yeah, that I can do that. But when I was down in Venezuela observing their music programs down there, you'd see four-year-olds playing cello, double bass, viola,
wow,
violin. And I remember one of the music teachers down there said, well, don't you have a kindergarten in your school? And I went, yeah, I do. He said, so why aren't you starting with kindergarten? And so I realized I was the one that was placing limits. It had nothing to do with the kids.
With the kids' ability.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And they're proving that. They're just absorbing it at incredible rates.
Wow. And you get support from the parents as well to have their kids involved in this?
We do.
Yeah.
It was really exciting because we got grants from the Association of Alaska School Boards and Douglas Dornan Foundation to buy instruments. And so we rotate. We have 60 instruments at school that rotate through six classes. But at the end of the school year, we asked kindergarten parents if they were interested in buying reduced, you know, priced violins. And over 50% bought violins for their kids. So it was incredible support that this meant something and that every time I'd run into a parent, they'd say how much their child talks about playing the violin, showing them how to play it, what the positions are. So it is something that is carrying into the home, which is what we'd hope to see.
Yeah, and practicing during summer maybe too, right? That's the idea.
Yes, last year Mr. Shah, Guohua Shah's the local
he's
incredible. Yeah. In fact, I couldn't imagine starting this program without his help. And so he has really spearheaded this, and we work in tandem. What makes the model so strong is that the kindergarten teachers come with their class, and they learn alongside the kids, and the music teacher is there along with Guohua Shah. And so together, we work off of each other's strengths, and then we also learn from each other at the same time. And he was kind enough to offer group lessons in the summer for those kindergarten students. So we had about 25 that signed up for that, and now we expanded into first grade, where they continue to have 90 minutes of violin during their part of their school day, and then once a week they have an after-school club.
Okay.
So that they can start building, getting ready for second grade.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I was going to wait till later, but this El Sistema, which means the system, is something you got exposed to. You're chosen to go down to Venezuela. Tell us about how the program came about, and as well as what's going on in Venezuela. Why that country?
Yeah.
Which, you know, everybody thinks of Hugo Chavez. I live down in Latin America. So it sounds pretty advanced. I mean, Venezuela is advanced, but... But what was your experience?
Well, this El Sistema program is inspiring, and it continues to feed me as far as knowing what can be after experiencing it for 2 months down there. The 10 of us went, and for me, you know, I'd seen videos of Dudamel, who sort of the prodigy that's come out of
this.
He's Gustavo Dudamel, who's now the conductor for the LA Philharmonic.
Yeah, right.
And for me as a teacher, I just wanted to know, okay, I see the end result, but, you know, what does that look like for a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old? And so we went down there. They just opened their doors to all of these centers called Nucleos, where children come after school and are there until, you know, 6, 8 o'clock at night, depending on how old they are. And it started by Dr. Abreu. He's an economist and a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw the power of music to motivate kids, but also uplift communities.
Wow.
And it really has transformed families. They come, children begin to see what they can do and what they can become. And he talks about the orchestra as a metaphor for an ideal society, because everyone has a different role and everybody contributes to something greater than themselves.
That's beautiful.
Yet they all have to come to agreement in order to create that beauty. And that's exactly what we saw. And we saw it at such a young age. He uses the orchestra as the beginning point. And I think that's the difference in music education here in the United States. We tend to wait until they've had private lessons on their own, and then when they're good enough, then they can move into the orchestra.
Mm.
But he said, no, the orchestra is the place where you begin.
Wow.
And it's not a music program. He'll be the first to say it's a social service program that creates exceptional human beings who will contribute to their communities. And they build leadership skills from the very start. So a child who can play four notes can teach a child who can only play three. So they start that leadership and self-confidence early on.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, is this just available for private schools then in Venezuela? Is it something the government supports?
It started out really, now the government has, and what makes Dr. Abreu an incredible individual is that he's been able to have the government continue to fund this over several different presidencies. But initially it was very grassroots and just started in the communities, and they continue to grow. I mean, there's over 3 million children over the 35 years that have gone through the system. And he was awarded the TED Prize in 2009, which was, the mission was to share ideas worth spreading. And his wish was to train 50 musicians who are passionate for music, for social change, to bring El Sistema to the rest of the world.
Wow.
And so I was very fortunate to be one of those first 10.
Yeah.
And that Alaska.
That's amazing, Lori.
Alaska has been like the northernmost initiative in our
yeah,
country. I mean,
yeah,
there's only a handful of us, and we're doing it here in Juneau and doing it very successfully.
Amazing. So the 10 that were kind of these guinea pigs, you guys spread out around the world. I don't know if you've kept in touch. Have you kept in touch with these colleagues?
Yes.
To check in with them and how their programs are going.
We definitely help each other out.
Uh-huh.
I've been to several of their initiatives and learned from them. And then they've come to Juneau to learn from
the
us.
Summertime.
Yes. No, unfortunately, they came in October. But and then the current fellows, they're in their third class, three of them chose to come to Juneau as for their internship to learn how to build a program and work within a school model. So our little initiative is gaining a lot of international attention. It's very exciting to see.
And you also mentioned in a book that came out, Changing Lives, right? You have a blog, which we should mention, the name of the blog.
Yes, it's JunoMusicMatters.blogspot.com.
Okay. And on that, or this is the first entry was about this book being published, right?
It is. I've been blogging since I started the fellowship. So if you're interested in, you know, what that year was like in Boston, Venezuela, and Scotland, that's how it first started. And then I continued with it to share the work that we're doing in Juneau, just as a way to share what's worked, what hasn't, so that idea of continuing to share. I think that was one thing that I really admired in Venezuela, was that their doors were always open.
Mm.
I think sometimes music teachers are a little protective of not sharing until they're performance ready. And there was a humbleness of, you know, when you walk into this room, you may have something that you can share to help us do our job better, and vice versa. And so my goal is to keep those doors open so that anyone who can come in can share what they see, and hopefully we can give something back.
Yeah, that's great. I wonder if maybe some of that's cultural, too. I know Latin society is very open and
shares very warm, and very much so.
Warm climate-wise as well. Tropical places. They love to dance. So you've got this great blog. And you also, with this work, you became Alaska Teacher of the Year last year in 2011. Was this part of your platform? Is this mainly what you talked about? Would you speak at different places all around the United States?
Yes, very much the arts, promoting the arts in our schools and in education has been very much the emphasis. Mm-hmm. And I was honored that Alaska wanted that from, there was only one other teacher from Alabama that was a music teacher, and really promoting a comprehensive education for our kids, that the arts should be a part of it. And I was talking earlier that Senator Begich came to our school because there is currently now sort of a momentum in the educational field for STEAM, that the arts really are this motivator, that it's not just science, technology, engineering, and math,
STEM. Mm-hmm.
But that we need to put the A in there because that's what motivates kids, it engages them, it helps them connect to other subjects, and in a world where creativity and innovation are now it's something that the workforce is looking for, we really need to make it core area for kids.
Wow. So did you feel like Senator Begich, well, he played the violin at your school, which is on the front page of the paper.
He did.
He also addressed this issue in the legislative address.
He did.
Right?
He talked about that this is something that really needs to be a priority for our state and for our country if we want to remain competitive. I know that the rest of the world is certainly picking up on that idea that it's about problem solving, it's about thinking across multiple disciplines to come up with innovative ideas, and that the arts are a perfect way of helping develop those skills in our kids.
Mm. Do you think he was received well with that message? Have you talked to other legislators? Obviously probably the Juneau delegation, but people involved in policy here.
It's an interesting time. Mm-hmm. I remain optimistic that our education is not narrowed to the testing. I think a lot of the testing
models,
has narrowed our curriculum to a point where we only see children through reading, writing, and math, and yet there's so much more that our kids have and can give if we allow that in our schools to help develop. I know that I would not be who I was if I didn't have music. I continue to be a slow reader. I love reading, I remember in first grade, I took a Basel reader and I took a poem and turned it into a song to help me repeat it over and over and over again. And I think kids find the arts very accessible and help them be successful. And our families, it helps bring families into the school because they see what their kids can do, not just focusing on their deficiencies. I think sometimes that can isolate families from schools.
Yeah, definitely. So that's hopefully a message resonates with people in leadership in our state. Now, you're trying to showcase this program next week, right? The JAM, for the listeners, is the Juneau Arts and Music Matters, right? I gotta realize that.
Along with our other program, which is Art is Elementary.
Okay, Art is Elementary is the other one. So you want to showcase it, which I don't know if I'll be able to go. It's during the day, right?
It is during the day, which it's an opportunity for the community to come out and see what can happen when community partners with the school. As I mentioned earlier, we have businesses, organizations that donate or sponsor a classroom for the arts. And so we started out focusing on a community artist. Currently we have Barbara Craver, who comes in and works alongside a classroom teacher.
Okay.
She finds out what they might be working on in science, social studies, language arts, and then they find a medium, an art medium, that they pair that to help the kids make connections to that core subject. And since then, we've moved into ballroom dancing with Pat Bielek through the Artist in Residency Grant. And again, it's much more than the art form. The ballroom dancing teaches respect. It's sequencing. And we've been encouraging the governor to come because we think it would be a perfect solution to teaching kids how to treat one another with respect.
Mm,
you know, he's talking
campaign,
about the yes against domestic violence. You have young men with their shirts tucked in, escorting a lady down the hall to get ready to dance, asking her to dance politely, and then bowing afterwards. And that whole interaction is taught early on where children can develop those habits. So you'll see ballroom dancing, and then you'll see 9 classrooms where teachers will open their room to demonstrate lessons that integrate the arts.
Okay. Could you give us a couple examples or your favorite ones maybe?
Well, we have Nancy Peel, who's a 4th and 5th grade teacher, and she's going to be modeling the drama technique of tableau, where children, it's like a frozen picture.
Okay.
And they stand up and act out different parts of scenes from a book. We have Glenda Lindley and Kim Frangos, a 4th grade class in Indian Studies, doing basket weaving from Alaska Native Aleut culture, tying that in. We have Hans Chester, who will be showing how he integrates Tlingit language into his literacy work. And we'll have Ellen Canapari, who works with a woman from the community to knit. And what kinds of skills are tied into learning how to knit with her class. And then we have Susie Denton from our PE program, Physical Education, who took a training on, it's called Drums Alive, and you can see it on YouTube, where they have stationary stability balls.
Okay, yeah.
And they put them in baskets, and the kids drum on them.
So
it's an aerobic activity, but she's built in mathematical concepts to work with it, just to build in the idea of that, you know, exercise is good and works right along with learning your math facts.
Gee, that sounds like a lot of fun. So this will be next Thursday.
This will be next Wednesday.
March 14th
from 9 to 11. And we understand people's schedules are very busy, so you can come in at any time. We have the lessons from 9:30 to 10:20. You'll get to see the violin program as well. And then at 10:30, our ballroom dance, 3rd, 4th, and 5th graders will come into the gym and dance. And then we'll end with our rock band.
We have a
rock band that will be playing Twist and Shout and 1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock. It'll be a very festive day, but educational as well. And it's just an opportunity for us to thank all of the sponsors in our community that help bring these arts to our kids who wouldn't normally have that opportunity.
That's great. Hopefully somebody could video it and maybe put it up on YouTube,
yeah,
right?
That's a great idea.
The ballroom dancing, is that up there as well?
It is.
Yeah.
We actually, when I was in Washington, D.C. last year for the Teacher of the Year ceremony, I talked to the Department of Education. They wanted to know if we had any ideas of how to engage parents, kids, and teachers. And I said, we have a ballroom program. And so it's up on their U.S. Department of Education blog.
Really?
And
you can
Google on YouTube, Glacier Valley, Heart and Soul.
Heart and Soul. That's awesome. Now, we don't have too much time left, but what's next for you? What does the future hold? And what other artists, for example, do you have this ballroom dancing one? Are there any dream artists that you'd love to come in?
Oh, my gosh. Programs? Well, you know, I've been really focused on expanding JAM beyond Glacier Valley walls.
Okay.
My dream was really to see this become more of a district-wide program. And so I've been working with Riverbend Elementary School, the other Title I school in our district, and they're just down the street. So the opportunity for both schools to collaborate is really good. So I hope that we can start a kindergarten program, violin program there next year. And we just received 13 cellos.
Really?
So we are...
Can we give a shout-out to who donated them?
We sure can. Association of Alaska School Boards, Douglas Dornan Foundation, and an organization in Boston, Classics for Kids. And they are the most beautiful cellos. The kids love them. We brought them out 2 weeks ago and just started playing on them. And that's the next step. When they move into second grade, we'll really begin to form an orchestra where we'll have a first and second violin section and cellos.
Right.
So that's where my focus is right now, is just to help expand this program and reach more kids.
Great, great. And you can reach us as well. The audience out there is listening. They can go on your blog, junomusicmatters.blogspot.com. Great memory. And you can follow Lori Hagee there, who is talking about your amazing work. Thank you, Lori, for coming on and for everything you do to make a difference in this community and in the country and the world.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks again to the listeners out there. This is Adrienne Lopez on the Alaska Identity Project with Martha Moore as well in the studio doing the studio engineer work. Thanks again. We'll see you next week.